The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In geology, a fault line is where earthquakes come from. Two tectonic plates are pushing up against each other, building pressure for many, many, many years. You get some tremors now and then, but one day comes the big one, and that quake is massive and destructive. In politics, there are also fault lines. Pressures build over issues. No one wants to compromise or give an inch, and then one day there is a massive eruption, maybe even a civil war. There are fault lines built into our Constitution. That's according to our guest today, Sanford Levinson, professor of government at the University of Texas Law School at UT Austin, and Cynthia Levinson, educational policy consultant and researcher. And they are the co-authors, husband and wife team, co-authors of Fault Lines in the Constitution. Our phone line is 210-614-8980. Call in with your questions and comments about the Constitution. What about it? Do you think got it wrong? You know, it's not really a perfect document. In fact, you can make a pretty good argument that the Constitution is pretty messed up. The number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. So Sandy Levinson, Cynthia Levinson, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
So Cynthia, tell me, what are the big fault lines?
Well, we have 20 fault lines, count them, 20, in the second edition of the book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. I think a lot of people would be familiar and sort of immediately name what Sandy calls gerrymandering and I call gerrymandering, or, say, the Electoral College. Those are certainly at the top of people's lists. But working on this book with him, I came to the conclusion that actually it's the existence of the Senate, and in particular, of course, the fact that every state, regardless of the size of its population, has two senators, the biggest fault line of all. I think the fact that, say, Wyoming or North Dakota or Rhode Island has two senators, as does Texas, is a great inequity and leads to gridlock and to inequitable distribution of funding. And even, as we point out in the book, the likelihood of increasing childhood obesity.
Yeah, I think that's talking about the Senate, and that's and how we arrived at that was a fundamental agreement when we came up with the Constitution. In fact, it is so deeply baked into the Constitution that it cannot be altered. Sandy, is that correct?
Yeah, basically, it would require unanimous consent, which means, practically speaking, that you're absolutely right. The word agreement is right, but it needs an asterisk, because James Madison, for example, hated that feature of the Constitution. In Federalist 62, he refers to the equal voting rule as a necessary evil. Why was it necessary? Because, as with slavery, without compromising on the voting of the Senate, there would have been no Constitution. Same thing is true with regard to the concessions made about slavery. So you try to pay your money and take your choice. How important is it to you to get the Constitution in the first place? That turned out to be supremely important to Madison, and therefore he said, we basically have to accept this evil. But in Federalist 62, not only did he describe it as a necessary evil, he also said, in effect, that the only defense of it was necessity of compromise to get the Constitution. And that's right historically. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But as with slavery, where nobody would say, well, the framers said that slavery on balance was acceptable and indeed needed to be accommodated in some very vicious ways. Therefore, we should never have questioned that. So that's the real tension with the Senate, that you're right, that as a practical matter, it may be that nothing can be done without a monumental political earthquake. But it's a real problem that we never discuss it.
Sure.
And never discuss the consequences of Vermont having equal voting power with Texas.
Right. So, or Rhode Island, you know, people talk about, and you talk about this in your book as well, how there are a majority of states that have a minority of the population, and they have distorts the one man, one vote voting power in the Senate. But the Senate is not the only way that we craft laws or govern the nation. We also have the House of Representatives, and then we have a president that is sort of, kind of, but not really voted, you know, by the nation. So really what we're talking about, so when we have the Constitution, is the Constitution an agreement by the states to form a federal government? That's basically what it is, right? It is agreement of the states, and so that's where most of the power in the nation actually resides, in the states.
Well, what you have asked is the most fundamental question of American constitutional theory, where there is no agreement, and it ultimately led to the Civil War in 1861. That is to say, there is one view identified particularly ultimately with John Calhoun and Jefferson Davis, but also others as well, Madison and Jefferson in 1798, that the Constitution was created by the states. It's a compact among the states. Four members of the current Supreme Court hold that view, most prominently Justice Thomas. On the other hand, there is the opposing view that we the people, in the preamble to the Constitution, refers to the American people who come together to create this government. And they are not coming together as Virginia, North Carolina, et cetera. They're coming together as the American people. Now, this is all very metaphysical.
Yeah, but it's a fault line. That is one of the significant fault lines. Is it an agreement between the people, or is it an agreement among the states?
That's exactly right.
And really quickly, Cynthia, give me your take on that in 45 seconds.
Well, we talk a lot about the attempt by the framers to encourage or force the representatives from the states who came to the Constitutional Convention in 1787 to form a country, a more perfect union, as it were. And there were complaints, especially during, not only at the convention, but also during the year afterwards, when this draft Constitution went out to the states for consideration. How dare they, basically, was a response by a number of people in the states, say that we're a country, we're separate countries. Several people said, it is Virginia that is my country, Massachusetts is my country. So there was a lot of work to be done. We have certainly gotten closer to looking at ourselves as a country, but that tension continues.
All right, we're going to take a break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're having questions and fault lines and pressures building in our Constitution today, but they're not brand new. They've been around for a very, very long time, but now those tremors are getting stronger. So where do they come from? How can we find ways to relieve that pressure without that destructive quake? We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. President Trump was not elected with the popular vote, but he was not the first president elected by the popular without the popular vote, elected by the Electoral College. So this is something that's existed for quite some time, having Electoral College, having people complaining about it and not really understanding why do we have it and what's it for and is this a good thing or a bad thing. And these discussions continue today. This has been identified as one of the fault lines in the book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, the Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. We're joined by the authors, Sandy Levinson and Cynthia Levinson. Sandy is a professor of government at the University of Texas Law School, UT Austin, and Cynthia is an education policy consultant and researcher and an award-winning author of like middle school books or young authors?
Picture books through young adult.
Right. So, and this book is written kind of like at that level as well. So it's perfect for the president that we have now.
Several people have said that, including a very well-known young adult author named Laurie Hulse Anderson, who wrote in the New York Times that she thought the president should read this book.
Yeah, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, he's just not a big reader, and that's an established fact, okay? So we just accept it, just like we have to accept many of the blemishes or oozing ulcers that are actually in the Constitution that you call.
But it's not clear that we need to accept them. I think one of the points of the book actually is, particularly when one writes for young readers, one looks for hope and for action. You had David Hogg quoted just before this program, just before we started, and we want young people to take action, and we include ways that they can do that.
Right. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. We're talking about fault lines in the U.S. Constitution. And so I just want to make a point here. I mean, it's really easy to have one of these meandering conversations about the Constitution and because it's so fascinating and affects us all. But really what I want to focus on is identifying these fault lines, how they impact us, and how can we relieve pressure on them before we get to these really big standoffs and we have a breakdown in the government. And so I think one of these fault lines is the Second Amendment. You know, what the framers wrote about having guns and what we think about that today. And so, Sandy Levinson, can you tell me about, like, what did the framers, do you think, actually intend for gun ownership?
Well, again, there is huge controversy about this. I wrote an article now about 30 years ago on this called The Embarrassing Second Amendment. And the title, in part, is meant to refer to the embarrassment that political liberals, and I would include myself in that description, have with the amendment that basically we would like to ignore it or give it the most minimal possible meaning. So for years, it had been kind of accepted, including by the Supreme Court, that all the Second Amendment meant was that states had a right to have their own militias, but that the Second Amendment in no way protected any sort of individual right. The argument in my article, as an historical argument, was that if one is trying to figure out why the Second Amendment is in the Constitution, it really has to do with 17th and 18th century political theory that took real form in the American Revolution, or what I prefer to call the American Secession from the British Empire, where ordinary people picked up their muskets and organized to overthrow what they believed, rightly or wrongly, was a tyrannical government. That, I think, is the basis of the Second Amendment. The fact is that relatively few people today, even those who defend gun rights, are willing to go down that particular path. Instead, they talk about guns as a method of self-defense against criminals, and quite frankly, I don't think the original Second Amendment has much to do at all with that kind of self-defense. I think it has to do with an image. I mean, think of the Minuteman Monument in Concord, for example. It's the image of we the people coming together with our weapons to overthrow a tyrant. And, you know, you may or may not believe that has any relevance to the 21st century, but if you're going to try to understand why it's there, I think that's the real reason. But the Supreme Court, in a 2008 decision interpreting the Second Amendment, basically ignored this sort of civil liberties or popular government notion of the Second Amendment in favor of a right to self-defense against criminals. And quite frankly, I think the Supreme Court was making it up.
So there's this famous photo of Mitch McConnell standing in front of the NRA, and he's got holding a musket above his head, a la Charlton Heston, and it's a musket. He's not holding a Bushmaster with extended magazines.
Right.
It's a musket. But it's Mitch McConnell, leader of the Senate. So that brings us to the other fault line in the Constitution is how we have leaders who are able to distort power and be able to block progress or, the majority of the American people want background checks. They want to have some sort of responsible gun control. We're not able to get there. So how is that happening? How is that? What fault lines are we seeing when we see that picture?
Well, I think it was Cynthia was saying that the House of Representatives, with some regularity, has been willing to pass gun control legislation, including, I think, literally this week. It is the Senate where that legislation goes to die. And that is in part not only because of the politics of the Republican Party, but also the fact that people who live in small, relatively rural states like to have guns for hunting. I don't have a personal objection to that, though I don't hunt. And they have disproportionate powers. So Bernie Sanders in 2016 had to explain why it is that in 2016 he had a pretty good record as far as the NRA was concerned. And the answer is really, really simple. Vermont is a small rural state, and Bernie Sanders' constituents like guns. So that's part of the reason.
All right, and Cynthia?
Back on that. I think it's not clear how much kids are learning about the Constitution these days. Civics has been cut back, apparently. But most people, when they think about the Constitution or American government, they might think of checks and balances. That's one of the things they know. They think we have a bicameral system with checks and balances among the three branches of government. It's kind of basic. The problem is we don't have checks and balances if the people in leadership positions in each one of those branches doesn't want it to be that way. So if, for instance, the Senate majority leader, wants to defer to the president, then Congress is, in effect, diminishing its own powers and aggrandizing those of the president. So checks and balances only exist if the people who are elected to those roles maintain them, or appointed in the case of the Supreme Court.
Right, and in terms of that fault line with the Supreme Court, if we have nine of them now, if you get five stooges on the Supreme Court, then you basically corrupt that, and it's not going to be an effective checks and balance. Sandy?
But I want to go back to what Cynthia was saying, that we often talk about our bicameral system, and we have a chapter in the book, particularly on bicameralism, and how, unlike in a number of other countries that are bicameral, each of the two branches has a death ray veto over the other. So, you know, both House and the Senate have to agree on every dotted I and cross T. But actually, as we argue in the book, one of the other fault lines is the presidential veto power, because in effect, that often turns us into a tricameral system. So even if you have bipartisan majorities of both houses of Congress, as has happened recently, even in this political situation we live in, where Congress has tried to clip the president's power with regard to intervention in the slaughter that's going on in Yemen, or his support for a really vicious government in Saudi Arabia, he simply vetoed it. And that is an issue that ought to be more discussed than it is, that the original Constitution was written in a very real way to make it as difficult as possible to pass legislation. And all of us can think of legislation that we didn't want passed, and so we cheer the fact that there was a check that prevented some bad legislation from passing. But it's also true that the system was created in a way that it assures that lots and lots of good legislation won't pass. We begin our book by talking about anti-lynching legislation that got through the House of Representatives, was supported by the Republican president, Warren Harding, and it died in the Senate. This happened at least three times. And to this very day, we do not have federal anti-lynching legislation because of bicameralism. But it's also the case that, in some areas, both the House and the Senate have agreed, and then the president says no. And this ought to be a subject of much, much more discussion than it's getting in the current presidential campaign, where candidates talk about their programs, which you may or may not support. But if you do support them, we really ought to be discussing the actual probability of these ambitious programs surviving the bicameral system we've got, assuming one of them becomes president. And then, of course, if we have a divided government where you have Congress in one party, the president in another party, then Congress can pass legislation and the president will simply veto it. And we have just a formula for gridlock and endless frustration.
So if we have a greater understanding of this process and the flaws, do you anticipate that people will consider that when they make their choices, when they vote?
Well, there are many factors that go into decisions about voting. And as you can probably, as you know, I'm sure, one of our chapters is devoted to voting rights and how difficult it can be to get access to the ballot. We think that resolutions to these fault lines, and I just want to back up for just a minute to say that while we do have 20 fault lines, 20 chapters in here, we do not discuss the Second Amendment as a fault line, nor do we discuss the Supreme Court. And in fact, we don't point to particular people. There was mention of, if there's a five-person majority on the court that may support the president, then that would give the president a lot of power, which is certainly true. Which helps limit or causes a limitation of checks and balances. But we don't talk about political personalities so much as we do about the structural issues that, such as, the Senate and the presidential veto power and that sort of, and voting rights.
Sure, but the Senate is important, and the presidency and the Supreme Court also is pretty important. There is no Mayberry versus Madison in the Constitution. So that could be considered and there's not a whole lot about the Supreme Court in the Constitution. So we're going to talk, we'll move on, and we'll be talking about other fault lines in the Constitution. When we come back, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this.
Immigration.
I think
think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health. The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Fault Lines in the Constitution. We're joined with Sandy Levinson, professor of government at the University of Texas Law School at UT Austin, and Cynthia Levinson, educational policy consultant and researcher. And so the power of the presidency seems to be something that has grown and grown. And has that become a fault line in the Constitution, Cynthia?
Yes, we have two chapters in particular, two brand new chapters in this second edition on particular powers of the presidency. That section is called Can the President Really Do That? So one of the chapters is on the presidential pardon. Whom can the president pardon? Whom can he or she not pardon? Can the president pardon himself? That's one aspect. The other one is, whom can the president hire and how and fire? That's about the unitary executive, the power of the president to not only hire and fire staff, including, say, cabinet members, but also those who work within the White House itself. So, for instance, John Bolton has considerable power and reports directly to the president in regard to foreign affairs and national security, which can put him at odds with the cabinet members.
Was not confirmed by the Senate. No national security advisors are confirmed by the Senate, and they can't be subpoenaed to testify. What has happened, and this isn't only Donald Trump, I mean, what Trump does in some ways is to provide a very sharp outline of some of the realities of the American constitutional system, particularly since World War II. And one of them is that there is, in effect, a shadow government not confirmed by the Senate, located in the White House. The most important single individual is the National Security Advisor, but there are lots of others, including his daughter and son-in-law. And this is something we ought to be having a conversation about. There's one other thing I'd want to say about the president. When you ask Cynthia what her most important fault line was, she said the Senate. And I certainly think the Senate is way, way up there among the 20. But at this particular moment, that is 2019, I have come to the conclusion that in some ways the most important fault line is that the only way you can get rid of a president, or actually there are two ways we can get rid of a president other than an election. One is the 25th Amendment, which we talk about at some length, which is completely unworkable unless you have a president basically who has had a serious stroke and is simply, obviously, physically incapacitated, or the impeachment clause, which I also think has become fundamentally unworkable in part because it's been captured completely by lawyers. So that I personally think we'd be much better off if we had a provision similar to what a lot of parliamentary systems have, and one of the things that's distinctive about our book is that there are a lot of comparisons in it. One of them is parliamentary systems that allow votes of no confidence, but we also write a lot about the other 50 constitutions in the United States, that is, state constitutions, which are very interesting and very important. So that California and Wisconsin both allow recall elections. And incidentally, with regard to the so-called unitary executive, Texas is at the other end of the spectrum. The governor can appoint extraordinarily few executive branch officials. And, of course, we elect judges in Texas, for better or worse. So the states really do provide, in many ways, alternative pictures of how to organize our government. And our hope is that kids and their parents and grandparents become educated to that fact and start arguing with one another about whether the Texas Constitution is better or worse than the U.S. Constitution, whether the Wisconsin Constitution with its recall provision is better or worse than the U.S. Constitution. Those are the debates we really need to be having and which are completely absent in our kind of public political discourse.
Our phone number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. If you have a question or a comment about the U.S. Constitution, what fault lines do you see? How should they be addressed? What bothers you? Do you think this is going to continue to hold together? How could it fall apart? Got a comment from the Twitter with Bob. Some people want to change. If some people want change, then they should reach out to the representatives and request them to call a constitutional convention. Cynthia Levinson, a constitutional convention, what's that?
Well, that's a great suggestion. Sandy and I literally have a debate about that in the second to last chapter of the book. When Sandy was talking about the fault line that he considers the most serious in regard to how to replace the president, I actually thought he was going to say that the most difficult fault line is the difficulty of changing the Constitution or amending it or getting rid of these fault lines, which you raised earlier. But I believe that he thinks that the best way to change it is, in fact, to have a second constitutional convention. That scares me to pieces, as it does many people. I think Sandy only knows a couple of people, in fact, who agree with him. The reason it concerns me, although I do think we could be facing a tsunami as a result of our Constitution, the reason it concerns me is that there are no guidelines for how a convention would be called, who would come, what authority they have, what role would big states or small states have, what role would the general population have. There's no process that's known, and I think we would fall into a sort of pre-convention crisis even before we got to the convention. Many people point to the possibility that there would be a runaway convention, and who knows what might end up in it, or who knows what might end up going away, say, the First Amendment. I know Sandy's less worried about that. He thinks that would be under control. But let him speak in favor of the convention.
Yeah, I do favor a new constitutional convention. I think that is for two reasons. One, there are certain things that could be addressed and changed. As a practical matter, ironically enough, only through the extreme process of the new Constitutional Convention. But secondly, what would be so extraordinarily valuable about a new Constitutional Convention, and I should note incidentally, there have been 235 or so state Constitutional Conventions. Again, this is why it's really important to be aware that state constitutional history is very different from our national constitutional history, that one of the things that happens in a state constitutional convention, it's like going to the doctor for a checkup or taking your car in to the mechanic just, to have it looked at, that we would be having the kinds of conversations we're having this hour.
Have you ever taken a car to a mechanic and have it looked at and something, he does something funky to it, and next thing you know, you're paying lots of money for stuff. When people are honorable, things go well. And if people were honorable, we wouldn't need government. There's a lot of funky stuff going on in the world right now, and you have to consider that.
Sure. But I think, you're right that a single mechanic or a single doctor could certainly make things worse. But if you had a convention of 600 or 700 fellow Americans, I think most of them would rise to the occasion and have a serious conversation. And would end up talking respectfully with one another. It would be the ultimate reality television show in the positive sense. That is, it would certainly be covered on C-SPAN, other public radio and television. And I think people would get hooked because many of them would realize for the first time that we really ought to be asking whether the president has too much power to veto legislation. Maybe there should be a veto power, but maybe it shouldn't require two-thirds of each house to override it. Or you can look at the fact that almost all state governors have the power of so-called line item vetoes, which the president doesn't. And a convention would go on certainly for months and spark a national conversation. So, you know, it's my own bad metaphor, because I don't think we would ultimately be in the hands of a single unscrupulous mechanic or a single dicey doctor.
And real quick, your response, Cynthia, really quick.
Yeah, sure. There's a preliminary possibility. The framers held straw votes during the Constitutional Convention. We suggest that there be straw constitutional conventions. Kids could have them. Communities could have them. States could have them. They wouldn't be binding yet, but they would open up these questions to people to become aware of and to talk about.
And whatever they come up with still has to be voted into law and or into legitimacy, and that's still something that has to be considered. We're going to take another break. If you've got a question or a comment about our Constitution and some of the flaws that are built into it, the number is 210-614-8980. Do you believe the Constitution is a living document? Do you think we should go according to what the founders believed, originalist interpretation? How does that work? 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, talking about fault lines in the Constitution. Sandy Levinson, is the Constitution a living document? What does that mean?
Well, that term usually comes up with regard to courts interpreting the Constitution. And as Cynthia says, we really don't focus on that. I teach that, but the importance of the book, frankly, is that we focus on structures that are hardwired into the Constitution that lawyers themselves almost never talk about because they're never litigated. You can't walk into a courtroom and sensibly say, Your Honor, the Senate is not only unfair, but it's unconstitutional. It's clearly constitutional. Ditto with regard to the fact that we elect presidents through the Electoral College and so on and so forth. So, you know, if we were talking about how the courts interpret the Constitution, I personally don't think there's any serious debate that the court has always interpreted the Constitution as a living document. But as I say, we're focusing on the decisions made in 1787 that have really stuck and are almost not only never litigated, but unfortunately never really discussed. So that a number of the presidential candidates have said they believe in the need for structural reform. But frankly, only or primarily Pete Buttigieg has been specific enough to say that one of the structures we need to reform is the Electoral College. And what I would love to see is the candidates have their feet held to the fire and ask them if they believe that we need to think more than we do about structural reform of the Constitution itself and how they would do that. One other point, I'll try to make it very quick. We do not engage in founder bashing. They were doing the best they could in 1787 to solve really terrifying political problems. Indeed, what we admire most, or what I admire most about the framers, was their audacity and their willingness to say that the Articles of Confederation, for example, were imbecilic, and we really needed to engage in radical change. That's the Philadelphia Convention. What we do today is view the decisions the framers made as close to holy writ, but we don't really talk about the fact that what was most important about the framers is that they were idol breakers and really asking always whether or not the existing system of government was working well.
Cynthia Levinson, the Electoral College, how that is in the Constitution. How did we arrive at that, and how is it still working?
Well, we all know how it's still working in that we have had several presidents recently who have been inaugurated, even though they did not win most of the votes, and certainly did not win even a majority of the votes. It came about because the framers weren't sure how to choose a president. There were suggestions that the Senate should choose the president. It was a long series of discussions about beginning with how many presidents should there be, for instance. There was a proposal that perhaps there should be three presidents.
We're operating simultaneously from different parts of the country.
Yes, exactly. There were discussions about what the president's job should be. There were even discussions about what the president's name should be. National executive was one. My favorite, I think, is the one that John Adams proposed, his high mightiness, his elective highness. I mean, they really didn't know what position they were coming up with. Some saw a sort of elective king who would be able to keep the office for life.
Right. So, but the term president, when they used it, when they said assigned it, it was at a time that that word really didn't have a lot of weight to it.
Right. But I think if you're trying to explain what's the Electoral College doing in the Constitution, Cynthia is right that part of it was improvisation at the very end of the convention. But what they were responding to, and it's not crazy in 1787, certainly, was the fact that we didn't have national means of communication. There was no reason to think that people in Massachusetts would have any idea of who capable leaders were in North Carolina or Georgia or vice versa. So the Electoral College was viewed as a way by which nationally sophisticated elites would pick the president, and the electors would be local notables who would be trusted for that decision. Also, one shouldn't ignore the role of slavery, because the Electoral College ends up enhancing the power of slave states, because slaves were counted as part of the basis for how many votes states got. And to this day, the most perverse consequence of the Electoral College is that it ends up encouraging voter suppression by politically dominant parties in given states, because the only thing that's important is that you come in first in a given state.
The winner take all.
And it's winner take all. And so there is a real incentive, and I think, frankly, you see this in Texas, you see it in Wisconsin, you see it in North Carolina.
It's in Florida, too.
And you're right. And this is in part because of the Electoral College.
Going back to the beginning, you know, the framers had hoped that there would not be factions, what we think of, what we call today, political parties. So the Electoral College was also based on a presumption that there would not be political parties.
Was that naive? I mean, you already had Alexander Hamilton running around. That seemed kind of like, where was their head when they thought that?
But they
wanted to try to forestall it.
They really came close to the Civil War in 1801, as a matter of fact, where the Electoral College turned out to be close to an unmitigated disaster.
Well, what about 1877?
Again, there were serious people who thought the Civil War would be re-inaugurated, and for better or worse, I think for worse, civil peace was purchased by allowing the Republican to become governor, to become president by one vote, one electoral vote, in return for a promise, basically to shut down Reconstruction and give
Ruth B. Hayes. So
right.
This shows that there are these fault lines. They have been there for a long time. So back to the metaphor, Cynthia, should we be looking for, and I think getting to a constitutional convention, if we get to that point, that means we've hit an earthquake and that we probably should be looking for ways to avoid that. Should we as a nation, as a voting society, as a people who are governed as well as governing, be looking for ways to relieve pressure through civil discourse on these fault lines so that we can continue to have the Constitution that we have now?
Well, I think Sandy would say that we need to have a constitutional convention in order to avoid
Well, there's got to be other ways.
Yeah. Well, because we talk about a number of different fault lines, we have a number of different approaches that can be taken. We talk about the filibuster. So one way to get rid of the problem with a filibuster is to change Senate rules. Some laws can be changed. One of the fault lines we discuss is the District of Columbia and how unfair it is, basically, for the people who live in the district not to be able to decide how their own tax money is going to be spent. So the laws could be changed, for instance, to either admit the District of Columbia into the Union or at least to give it a voting representative in Congress. There are also workarounds. We were just talking about the Electoral College. There is a national compact, which a number of states have signed, each state's Electoral College votes would go to the winner of the popular vote nationally, the popular election nationally. I don't know how effective that would be, but there are ways of trying to work around the Electoral College. And, of course, there are amendments. Now, we do have a chapter on the difficulty of amending the Constitution, but it's not impossible. It's happened. And so there are ways to address these fault lines before we really have a major earthquake.
And so, Sanford Levinson, is it important that we recognize that the Constitution does have these fault lines, these flaws, so that we can actually use it to best benefit?
Oh, sure. I mean, that unless we start having a national conversation where, as I said before, instead of talking vaguely about structural reform, people say, well, you know, one of the structures of the Constitution itself, and here are my suggestions for reform that we can kick around. Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, a couple of years ago, proposed what he called the Texas Plan, which involves 9 very important constitutional changes, and Abbott, in fact, supports a new constitutional convention. Now, I disagree with many of the governor's specific discussions,
right,
specific suggestions, but in a debate at the University of Texas Law School, I gave him at least one cheer for actually being willing to say, you know, there are problems. Here are my suggestions.
The book is called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Authors are Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Rospiedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.